back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. The Maryland Crab Cake Tour is back out on the road. We're going to be at Cooper's North on Friday. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. We'll have some Raven scratch-offs to give away, as well as Goodwill Industries, our friends at Window Nation, where I'm wearing the shirt. You can reach them at 866-90-NATION. And, of course, it is restaurant week all over the state of Maryland right now. Get out, support local restaurants. Lunch, dinner, all local. Chefs are all showing off. The food's going to taste delicious. Make sure you're taking advantage of Maryland Restaurant Week. This guy took advantage of Maryland back in the 70s. He paved the way for me to work at the Baltimore Evening Sun a decade later. He has been at the Boston Globe as their baseball writer and, of course, sports columnist and sports editor as well. Dan Shaughnessy, our defending champion. Dan, I used to bother you and Ryan and all those guys back in the day. Nick, when the Orioles and the Red Sox would get together 28 times a year or whatever. It feels like that's a little old, but the Orioles are coming back. But Patriots, Ravens, that's been a whole lot hotter than Orioles, Red Sox has been over this part of the century.
It has, and they've really been a very, the Patriots aren't what they were. So, there's no more Brady, no more dynasty, all that stuff. But in those years, in those two decades, the Ravens consistently were emerged as really the rival by the end of it. They could come in here. I always felt that Harbaugh wasn't afraid to come in here like a lot of coaches, and wasn't afraid of Brady. And they matched him game for game, year in and year out, because of the rugged defense that they played and their attitude and the talent that they had. Kind of go back to I know that your kicker, he got the job because Cundiff missed that chip shot, the 33-yarder, and 2011 sent the Patriots to the Super Bowl, and of course Tucker's been doing it since. But yeah, that it's been a great rivalry over the years, and I don't even know what's the spread for this week. The Ravens got to be favored, right?
Well, that's interesting you would say that, because I don't know what to make of the Ravens, and they look pretty good for three quarters, and then it all fell apart. I mean, talk about historic collapses and what this means for Harbaugh and the team and young players. And they got a lot of veterans. They got Calais Campbell. They got Marcus Peters. They got guys that have been up and down the river with these kinds of losses. But this is a really weird week, and it's weird coming up there with no Brady, right? Like, you come up there and you feel like, well, we have a chance. They don't have Tom Brady. But there is some mystique. And as I said, once that foghorn starts going off around 12:55, you find that you're in a different kind of place. And Dan, I'm not making the trip this year. Obviously, my whole fiasco with the Ravens and being up there, but being a part of it up there, I thought, well, the air's got to be out of the tires. Like, if I ran a bus trip up there, tickets got to be depressed. Tickets are still $200 to get in on the roof up there. Like, I'm shocked at the staying power that the Patriots have had with the fan base there, even though it doesn't feel like they're championship material right now.
That's all true. They built up a lot of reservoir with the fan base. There's still a long wait list for season tickets, and they don't have trouble selling out their building. This is also the first home game. It's the home opener for them. Beating Pittsburgh on the road gives them a little something to hang on, but they've been taking a pounding locally just for the way Bill's kind of gone into this season with no offensive coordinator and bringing back Joe Judge and Matt Patricia. And there's been a lot of criticism. It's been unusual. And that was not a particularly overwhelming victory on Sunday. Hey, you take a win in Pittsburgh anytime you can, but Trubisky's terrible. And, it was a rock fight of a game. And just there's still a lot of questions about the Patriots. So it's great theater. Anytime these two play each other, you talk about no Brady. When they played the Steelers, it was the first time that they played each other without Roethlisberger or Brady being in the game since 1998. I mean, so we've had a lot of continuity at that position, as Pittsburgh did. And everything's kind of new here, the Mac Jones era. And we'll see how they go. The defense looks pretty good. The O-line was better protected last week, but they have a lot of questions, especially on the offensive side of the ball.
Dan, you've been at this a long time, man. You've covered a couple of Camelots, through the Celtics era and your book there. And I know we've talked about that as well in recent times, going back to that. But all of the Curse of the Bambino, that was your thing. I was there at the turn of the century with Curt Schilling and his wife. And my wife found her Manchester Union Leader umbrella with all of the Red Sox 2004 winning every game. But that's 20 years ago now, and you saw the end of that, and Theo Epstein and all that went on with that era of that. this Belichick thing feels like it's still here. Where is the end of this? Does this feel like Bill's his own OC and he's bringing in his boys and getting to the end, or are we not getting to the end with this?
This is a critical mass at that right now, because it certainly felt like the end in their preseason this year, losing their opener at Miami. And it feels like the wheels coming off quite a bit. He's had a lot of bad drafts in a row. They spent a ton of money 2 years ago in the offseason. That got him in the playoffs last year, and Jones had a pretty solid, accurate rookie year. But we haven't seen improvement since then anywhere, including Jones. So you guys are walking into a good situation where they're very vulnerable right now, and it's not known how much the mystique of Belichick can kind of carry this thing moving forward, because I don't see him as having great talent anywhere in the field. They have okay talent, and the defense looks pretty good. But again, the win at Pittsburgh was just very non-convincing for a road win in the NFL. So see how it goes this week. But they're vulnerable, and they're trying to win like with 90s football, you know, ground and pound and defense. And that was great when Bill had Lawrence Taylor and his Giants team. But I don't know about now.
Well, Matt Jones and finding quarterbacks, and I found it interesting. I went to the owners' meetings back in March, and I wound up at a table with the new Vikings coach, Kevin O'Connell. Right. I wound up talking to him a little bit, and I thought, well, here's a interesting guy, San Diego State quarterback, and I'm thinking, oh, this is one of the guys that Belichick fell in on, 15 years ago to draft and say, maybe. I mean, I took Brady in the sixth round. Maybe I take a quarterback in the third round. Where are you with me? Because it's a very, very clear distinction of the kind of intellect and the kind of player that Bill Belichick wants around, that he feels like he has a vision, he did with Brady, to say this guy can be something. And I don't know where we are in the continuum of expecting a guy starting his second year to be a qualified playoff bona fide, we can win a Super Bowl with this kid. What do you like or not like about him? Or is he just the latest in line of Garoppolo and the rest that he's not really going to be the answer there?
Well, I think that, Bill certainly feels that the system is the attraction here. That's what prevails, that they can take anybody who's worthy of being here and incorporate them into the system. And that was one of the rubs at the end, I think, with Brady, is that he was like, hey, I'm the difference here. It's not your system. And I think that's where, after 20 years, it got to be too much for both parties. But so, Jones he's not a big arm, not very mobile, but he's accurate. He's a winner. He won at Alabama. He comes out of the Saban tree, which Belichick loves that, and had great poise, pocket presence in his rookie year, and was very accurate. But we've seen mistakes, and he's been intercepted twice. They're throwing a lot of 50-50 balls this year, which is a little sign of desperation. I think it might be a metrics thing. They think that that's a worthwhile play now. And he had one go in and out of the arms of a guy on Sunday. He really got away with one there. The decision-making hasn't been as crisp as we thought last year. And his offensive line was terrible in the first game of Miami. So, really, this is, this game is a twist. We'll see what the Ravens have for them. But I like the Ravens in this game just because I'm not a big fan of what the Pats are doing so far. And I don't see Jones better this year than he was last year. Not yet.
Yeah, I look up and down the roster and I see these familiar faces, like, Matthew Judon. I mean, a guy from here, right? And you talk about, Brian Hoyer's on this team. I mean, Devin McCourty, all these years. Lawrence Guy, another former Raven, still around. It really is amazing that once you're Bill's guy, you're Bill's guy for life to some degree, right? Unless you're Tom Brady.
I think that's totally true. And you see it with the staff and he's been in the NFL for like 48 years. I mean, it's some incredible number. So, he wants to catch the Shula record. He's about 30 south of that. He's 70 years old. But this is like the first time he's had kind of pushback within the market. Folks are questioning him. This will be a good theater, I believe, here on Sunday.
I don't know that he has anything left to prove, in regard to Canton or in regard to his wealth or a fistful of rings and all of that. But part of the proof would be, I can do this without Tom Brady. Tom Brady's done it without him. this is an interesting end of the book for guys like you that write these books, because we had no idea how this was going to turn out. But I don't know that anybody had Brady would still be playing in 2022, even though he's got off the field issues and whatever they are, but that he would become as decorated after he left New England. It really is sort of a pie in the face for Bill, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. The way it's gone. I mean, Brady goes and wins the Super Bowl right away. The Patriots are under 500 out of the playoffs. That wasn't a great party starter for Belichick. And, you know, he's going to have to live with the you never won without Brady. I mean, Red Auerbach, we would say you never won without Bill Russell. I'd say, yeah, what's your point? I mean, it's like he didn't really care about it. And for Bill, I think, yeah, I don't think he's – it's really possible for him to work long enough to have another dynasty or have that kind of – it's just not going to happen at his age. You might be able to get in there one time, but that's far off. So he may have to live with that. You never won without Brady. I don't know. But like you say, Brady, it's a freak, takes care of himself. And the way the rules have evolved, a guy who's as smart as he is, takes care of himself, can play back there and not get touched. And it's masterful genius to watch, and he's still able to do it. So good luck to him. But that argument hasn't worked in Bill's favor here since Brady left. You're right.
I cannot allow Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe to mention Bill Russell on this program without at least talking a little bit about that. And I'll say this for me, in my experience and seeing Johnny U die here, you know, obviously we still have incredible legends with Brooks, and we lost Earl Weaver, and we lost Artie Donovan. In my time here, these sort of iconic figures to our town and what Bill Russell meant to the sport, meant to basketball, the NBA and Boston and you and being involved in this. When we lost Saragusa here a couple months ago, you know, I didn't lose a cartoon figure. I lost somebody I knew. I'm assuming you knew Bill Russell pretty well over the years.
Well, he was a tough one. There was a force field around him, but he would turn on the charm every now and then. I mean, I grew up watching him the way you all grew up watching Brooks. I mean, that was just what we had, and they won every year. So we were really spoiled, 11 championships, 13 years. And I was in high school before. What do you mean they don't win the championship? It's like, wow. So yeah, it was just, it was a big hit for the community. He got to be 88 years old, and we knew it was coming. And they're all gone now, except for Cousy and Sanders. I mean, that whole group, and there's been tremendous attrition. People get old, and you don't expect people to live to be 130 years old. So in the last 3 or 4 years, Heinsohn, Havlicek, Sam Jones, Casey Jones, it's been a lot of attrition for those great teams, and hard hitting. And of course, none bigger than Russell, because he was the center, the focal point, and the consistent champion of the whole dynasty.
Dan, now that the Orioles have pulled themselves out of the lower depths of the American League East, if not Major League Baseball in general, this is an interesting time here for this organization, this city. You covered the Orioles back, and we would call it the glory era, but they didn't sell a lot of tickets back in the 70s when you were around. You were even sort of pre-Oriole magic in 79. Mm-hmm. Good teams, but whatever it is, I've watched this thing atrophy through all the Angelo stuff. The boys are fighting now, throwing mud at each other with the mother and who's going to get the money and who's going to own the franchise. But they're decent on the field. You've got a whole different story up there in Boston where they've had parades. They've had all of that. But right now there's an after effect of all of this, of expectation, and then the reality of how hard this is to do and how hard it even is to do if you're going to pay $200 million a year to try to do it.
Yeah, ownership here, they had the great run in the first, you know, they've won four championships since 2004, and that's tops in MLB, and they get a lot of, you know, they're playing off that in a big way, and nobody wins every year. We understand that, but they've had a pattern of inconsistency, which is alarming. This is going to be their fifth last place finish in 11 seasons. And that doesn't play around here. I mean, the Yankees have only.
By the way, that's hard to do with the Orioles in the same division.
Thank you. And you look at the Yankees. Yankees have been under 500 once since 1993, or maybe not at all, like 30 straight years. And I know they've only won one championship, well, in this century. But so, you know, I still don't like years that are lost when you're Boston, when you have the kind of payroll they have, the kind of resources they have. And they've had these stink bomb seasons every other year for the last decade. So, and the payroll is going to go very south in a big way. A lot of money coming off the books, you know, Eovaldi, JD Martinez, all those guys are leaving. All the money that's committed was done by Dave Dombrowski, and that stopped in 2019, and it hasn't come back. So critical time for them in my view, they've been passed by the Orioles. The Orioles have, you would take the Orioles' future over the Sox future right now. That's not something would have been said around here, you know, 1, 2, 3 years ago. So they've got some work to do with their fan base. They're still trading off Fenway Park and the Sweet Caroline and, you know, the world's most beautiful ballpark and all this old stuff, which is, you know, it's nice for the tourists and the pink hats and the trendies, but it's not particularly, doesn't play well with the grizzled old time baseball fans, which is still what you need because those are the people that still love the game.
Well, we're loving the game here. It's been a lot more fun this summer, you know, to get involved in baseball. I want to ask you this because, you know, of my recent vacancy being shoved off the purple boat and not having a press credential anymore after 26 years of doing this and owning a station. There's a new paper in town that's not a paper. It's called the Baltimore Banner. And I spoke to them 8, 10 months ago about maybe writing a column. And I started thinking in my mind, is this something I want to resurrect? Because I talk politics. I talk trends, culture, elections. I do all sorts of stuff here, but my basic DNA was in John Steadman, reading people like you and Mitch Albom and working with John Eisenberg and just great columnists. It's tradition of the Sun, of Kirchin and Rosenthal, who were all my colleagues back in the day. But writing a column in the modern era, I'm having folks like you on, I'm having Bob Ryan on, and I will be doing this probably for the next year, talking to columnists, decorated columnists, about what a column looks like in 2022, because it's so different with social media. And I would always say that it was harder being a Red Sox because of the way you wrote and the accountability that you and the Herald and all of you, you were hard asses in Boston. It was a tough place to play because they were held accountable by people like you. It's going away, Dan. You know that. And I don't know where that is or whether it's easier to be a Red Sox these days, given social media and the noise. But for a columnist and for someone with insight, wisdom, history, saw Bill Russell, that's what I want to read as a reader. I don't know where that reader is at this point.
Well, everything you just said is true. And it's, again, I try not to bay at the moon about it too much because it's evolution. I wish that the printed paper were still a big deal. And you go downtown, you can't find the printed paper. I understand that. No one under the age of 40 touches the printed paper. People are going to get their information. They're going to get their news. They're going to read their phones. They're going to get new platforms. So we have to deal with that. What it has done, everything you talked about, is sort of evolved toward, you know, less worthy stories, less criticism, and more clickbait stories and, you know, hot takes and quick things. And I find myself, I don't go out and talk to the high school quarterback as much as I did, because in those days you could change the kid's life and it mattered and it was a noble, worthy story. And now they don't notice. It doesn't change anything for them. Your readers don't read it. It's like, hey, why aren't you talking about Brady versus Belichick again, which is what they want every day. The cycle of news, the attention spans, it's just changed in a big way. And as a columnist, I find myself slipping into that much more. Quick stuff, hot take stuff. I'm a fast writer and that's handy, but I don't feel we do as much in-depth worthy stuff. And increasingly, fans have come to expect fan writing for fans. This is the Bill Simmons thing, the Barstool thing, which young people, they don't know anything else. And the expectation is everybody's on board. It's like reading the team website. So you don't have independent columnists being critical. For some reason, people are afraid of it or don't want to do it, or they're all fans writing for fans. And I have no interest in that. I mean, I love when the team's good and we celebrate that and we cover it and we, you know, enjoy it with the fans. But when things aren't good, we're there to call out ownership, call out, you know, underperforming players who are making big money, that kind of thing. And that's still what I do. It doesn't play as well with the younger audience in this era. I understand that. Too bad. I'm just going to keep doing it. And, you know, eventually I'll go away, and there aren't many who want trouble anymore. But the best guys that you've cited, like guys like Kirkjian and Rosenthal, I mean, they were never bomb throwers. They're just really solid baseball guys who are great storytellers. And that's kind of the ideal. So hold on to the guys like that. Be like that as long as you can.
Well, the amazing thing is you didn't need to be a bomb thrower with Angelos. He was his own bomb, right? I mean, like same thing with Steinbrenner or, you know, anything like that. But I would just say the critical part of this has gotten to the point, and look, I've had a purple bird head on, right? You will find no one. I've bought tickets for every Ravens game through my life and sat in the stands during games. I love the fact that we got a team back. I was here, you know, my father died in that era where we didn't have a team anymore, right? And you were here when the Colts were here. There was a civic part of it that now, three decades in, they're just a corporate team that happens to be, you know, $5 billion organization that happens to be plays their games 8 times a year in Baltimore, but is more of the world at this point. And I've said to folks, I think the Ravens need less fans and more critics. You know, it's become too cheerleader oriented. And I think certainly on the web, you criticize a tight end for dropping a ball. It's like you start to hear the color of his skin or crazy stuff in regard to criticism of athletes. And I'm thinking, and the kids that play the game now, far more thin skinned. And the fact that they would throw me out, who's a bit of a cheerleader, I'm thinking that's just so opposite of whatever Shaughnessy writes. He's going to show his ass in the clubhouse tomorrow and have to look at me after he writes it, right? Like, the fact that they don't want that accountability is astonishing to me. It really is.
Yeah, it's changed. That's the evolution that I'm talking about. And I think that it goes back to when you first said people writing from the fan perspective strictly and no kind of subjective, independent watchdog kind of mentality, which I always thought is what we are. You know, we're the eyes and the ears of the fans, and we get to kind of represent, go behind those scenes and do that. But as you say, always being accountable and showing up the next day. And, you know, if people don't like it, give them a shot to come back at you. That's only fair.
Well, Dan Shaughnessy's the best in the business up at the Boston Globe, always making time for us. It's probably because he covered the Orioles in Baltimore, my last name or something like that, or maybe my industriousness over the last 30 years. But it's great to see you. Always good to visit. And what's next? You got a book? Are you doing something? Promote something for me, Dan.
Well, the last book is still out there. It's called Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. It's on Amazon. It's really fun. If you like the old NBA, the Jordan Bird times, David Stern, Dream Team, this is the one for you. It's an era when we were able to get close to the athletes and tell the people what they were like. And they were a fun group, confident in their own greatness, privileged to be around it, much like the Orioles in the 70s and early 80s when I covered them.
No offense to Bird or Magic or even Isaiah Thomas. Yeah, I always wanted to be a Dr. J. You know, Dr. J was always my guy, you know.
He was a good one. He's a good one to have. Still is. Wonderful guy.
Dan Shaughnessy, the Boston Globe. Follow him out on Twitter. Read his writing. Buy his Celtics books. And, follow along with the Red Sox and the Patriots as the soap opera continues now 41 years into being at the Boston Globe. I am Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570, making all my guests jealous, talking about all those Maryland crab cakes we're having on Fridays. We are BaltimorePositive.com.